fact, the story I'm about to tell you sounds like a movie, but it's real. In 1974, when my next guest was 12 years old, she was kidnapped by a trusted family friend. The man picked her up from a piano lesson, drugged her, and kept her for 55 days as the two of them lived in a motorhome traveling from Idaho to Mexico. During the 2 months she was held captive, the man brainwashed her, causing her to believe in aliens and that it was her duty to have a child with him to save an alien planet. She was finally freed by Mexican police cooperating with the FBI and returned to her family. Later, at age 14, she was kidnapped again by the same man. He spent less than 2 months in jail for the first abduction and only 19 days and 5 months in a mental hospital for the second abduction. He served another year in prison in 1986 after he pleaded guilty to raping another child. And then last month, he tried to approach her again. Jan Broberg Felt is that woman. She's an actress appearing regularly on the television series Everwood and Touched by an Angel. 30 years after her abduction, she started to speak publicly about her experiences, along with her mother, Marianne, who wrote the book Stolen Innocence about the family ordeal.
I was very frightened, particularly for the safety of my own children and my family, and for the safety of any community that has people like this who are not in jail. This man is a repeat offender and obviously should not be.
Yeah. How is it? I mean, explain that. I mean, explain to me the theory. I mean, I know you don't support it, but how is it that this guy has served so little time for kidnapping you twice? And then I assume he's out already on the attempt to get at you again last month?
Oh, absolutely. He was charged with several misdemeanors and posted bail that very night. Yeah, unbelievable and disappointing to me. Well, the reason that I think people like this are walking the streets is because they prey on children. And when you have somebody who preys on you as a child, and then many years later, you're finally ready to talk about that experience. Either the statutes of limitations prevent you from prosecuting, or you as a person have tried to move on, forget, have had your counseling, and now you don't want to revisit that monster in your life, so you're not prosecuting. And also, most of these kinds of sexual predators are people that our children know and love, people that their parents know and love. And so it becomes this family secret.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor and writer-producer of CBS's Criminal Minds. With me today is...
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds.
Hi, I'm Jan Broberg and I'm just thrilled to be here today. I met Lisa when she was a casting director for Criminal Minds and cast me in a role that I found to be quite apropos to my past life experiences, although I hadn't shared those in a global way yet. So it was nice to make that connection and to be able to play that character. And I'm really thrilled to be here with such experts to talk about a subject that is very important to me. And hopefully we can raise some awareness and make an impact for the positive on the world.
Can I call you Janny? Janny?
Of course.
with our Janny Broberg, who is the subject of the incredible documentary Abducted in Plain Sight. And Jan, what's the name of your book?
Also called Abducted in Plain Sight, but I haven't released the new version, which has additional information. And we decided we didn't care that they generally say, oh, your book should be under 300 pages. We were like, no, we don't care. We're going to do more than that.
Great. Okay, well, let's jump right back into our conversation.
I had a question about the psychiatrist, because psychiatrists come up a number of times. The psychiatrist or psychologist that he says he saw and therefore was giving him this treatment, did that person actually exist or was that made up?
Well, I think when they went back, that is in one of the records on some of the investigation, is that actual person did not exist, but he had gone to Beverly Hills for something else, because that's where he said this psychiatrist was, but that the name of that person, they could never find that person. That's all I know.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, he was elaborate in the things that he did and said. And there's a half-truth, because there was a theory about overexposure. Therefore, you overexpose and therefore you get rid of the problem effectively. But it's utter bullshit made up by male psychiatrists who are probably pedophiles themselves to allow the abuser to carry on. The Diagnostic Statistical Manual was actually created by male psychiatrists and not by women, not for women. And many syndromes were just created off the back of someone's thought. No data. And that's a major problem, because there is a very clear gender bias when we talk about psychiatrists and psychologists and theories that get bounded around. But I also just wanted to make the point that the psychiatrist who did assess him when he was in the mental health facility, he was the one who really got my goat, in the sense that he assessed this individual B, very manipulative, probably a psychopath if he was to be indirectly assessed by Jim and I, but he allowed himself to be completely led by the perpetrator's narrative and completely bought into it without checking or corroborating any information. And again, to release him after 6 months, Jim, for what he did, I mean, it's absolutely asinine.
I was outraged. It just added more fuel to the fire. It encouraged him. It gave him more opportunity to get access to you. It actually reinforced his ability to be able to manipulate others. And this is one of the things, Laura and I, because we're behavioral analysts, we actually do indirect personality assessments. We don't rely on self-reporting. We look at behavior. We look at what they do. It speaks volumes for and is actually more accurate than many offenders will say. They won't admit to how they really feel or what they're really doing, what their real motivations are. And that's like why I said, Laura's talking about the over-immersion thing. In other words, there's a theory that, for example, hey, the best way to get rid of somebody's attraction to child pornography is to show them as much as they, you know, overload them with it and make them masturbate to it, and they'll eventually not want to see
like
it anymore.
It's like extinguishing behavior through like over...
Complete and utter crap, because we've had hundreds of thousands of cases where people collect child pornography. It started with, you know, people buying it, and they might have a few hundred images or 1,000 images. When the internet happened, that started to be tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands and millions, literally millions of images in one person's collection. So it really undermines that bullshit theory. And I hate when people become victimized because someone who is actually in a position to help them doesn't do their job. And that's what it seems. The system failed you. And we all at Real Crime Profile apologize for the system, because the system should have protected you, because your parents were manipulated and they weren't in a position to protect you. And so the system should have. The FBI tried. Maybe they didn't at the time know that this guy most likely had other victims, and so they didn't look. But if they had, I'm sure they would have found the prior cases, and they would have been able to put together a stronger case and lock him up the first time. Didn't happen.
I wanted to comment on that too, because the one girl that he started grooming while he was actually in the mental hospital, and her mother was a psychiatric nurse at that hospital. And he met her and he groomed her first and found out she had about a 9-year-old daughter. And I talked to her, and he, before the second kidnapping, he had already identified her. He'd already seen the daughter. He'd already started to make best friends with this mother, a psychiatric nurse. Single, but a psychiatric nurse, not a dum-dum. And as soon as the second kidnapping and he was out, all happened, she was the next victim. And she's the only one who at age 17, this had been going on for like almost 8 years with her. He had held her in his apartment for 119 days at one point. And the whole time he's best friends with her mother. And this girl told a friend at school she was going to kill herself because she hadn't accomplished her mission. And the friend called her mom and said, this is what, she, you know, I won't say her name. This is what she said at school today. And the mom being a psychiatric nurse, started to talk to her daughter, and finally, absolutely without, you know, pulled it out of her that her best friend, my same guy, had been raping her daughter under her nose for almost 8 years. They did prosecute him. And this is, he was in Salt Lake. By this point, he was divorced and he was in Salt Lake City. And he was found guilty for rape of a child. You can look up the report. Mm-hmm. And he was put in jail. But this girl, this woman who I talked to on the phone, when she saw we were making a documentary, she saw our site and sent me like a one sentence email. I'm the little girl that put him in jail. I know what you're going through. And she's the only one I've ever talked to that he Wow. played the same brainwashing tapes on. She had no idea that in less than a year, he was released from prison. She had no idea. She literally gutturally screamed on the phone when I told her, well, he didn't even spend a year in jail. And then she just fell to pieces and started sobbing and just gut wrenching. She's like, no.
It just shows what a serial perpetrator he was, and being able to infiltrate professionals as well. I mean, it's common. We see it all the time, but it's much more about his ability being the serial perpetrator, which is why I always say you have to assume they are serial. They learn their trade craft, and he did what worked for him over and over again, but with an elaborate, I mean, it's like a prisoner of war coercive control grooming process. First of all, they create a trust bond with somebody, and then they take over their mental perception. So they become the echo chamber, the only person that the individual talks to. And they can bring in like an external threat, i.e. yours was this mission and it seemed very real. And therefore he's the only one who understands it. So you are pushed more to dependency on him. Then they become omnipotent and omnipresent. So even when you're not with them, they're in your head, they're your thought, first of all, before your own. They create a threat, i.e. the mission or something that you need to be able to do or something that puts fear inside of you, and therefore they can control you. Sometimes there's a reward and punishment system or rules and regulations. And if you do X, Y, and Z, then it's fine. But if you break a rule, then there's a consequence for it. And those rules and regulations are really there to exact obedience from the person. And like I said, a lot of the behavior really is invisible to people. And the isolation, the sense that you can't talk about what's going on, your world, it's very real, but it sounds crazy to anybody else if you were to explain it. So I'm so glad that in the other lady's case, that her mother, the psychiatric nurse, really did start to ask questions about this mission. And unfortunately, you carried that burden for a very long time. And again, skilled abusers key in to, particularly with girls and women, to the fact that we have a high expectation sometimes placed upon ourselves to please or to meet somebody else's needs. And that's where really his mental acuity as a perpetrator, being able to gauge each of you in the family, but not just all of you, but the professionals like the psychiatrist who he says that he was abused to, and creates this narrative that is just bought into. And therefore his abuse becomes a sympathy factor, not a risk factor. And he has thought through all of these things. It was very clear how elaborate with the CIA and putting you into a Catholic school. These are very elaborate things that if you were to say it, people would think you were bonkers. But it just shows his level of premeditation and fantasy, doesn't it, Jim? This is something he would have been turning over in his mind over and over and over. And he created the opportunity with you. Yeah. He lived for it, and multiple victims. And he should have been stopped. He should have been stopped in the first instance. The church leaders knew what was going on. The psychiatrist knew what was going on. Police officers knew what was going on. And I think now it's so important for law enforcement that they must understand the nature of serial perpetration, and that these sorts of offenders, and they are plentiful, unfortunately, they don't just operate in a vacuum, and it's not just one victim.
That description is so perfect. I want you to like send me that, so when I go to speak somewhere, I can talk about that very, that the way you explained it in those steps, that is exactly what happened. Not only to me, but I can see it with my mom and my dad and my even my sisters as little girls. And, you know, with church members and people that after that first time, well, he didn't hurt her. And so he's manipulated them. And he, you know, you can't press charges. What will Gail do? What will the kids do without their breadwinner in the house? I mean, you know, all of the layers of people that were all led down that same, what did you call it? Coercive what?
It's the chart of coercion. And Biderman is a psychologist who looked at prisoners of war to understand how did they become so compliant? How did the mind control happen? And actually, it happens in 8 or 9 stages. It doesn't happen the minute you meet someone. It happens over time, gradually, and it's
important.
So insidious.
I was asking about this because I'm struck by how many children from very religious households are, I guess, targeted, first of all, but seem susceptible for somebody who wants to prey on their minds.
Absolutely.
Do you know what that's about?
Well, I think any time that you're taught to have faith in something, you should also be taught to find facts. If you're going to be taught to believe in something, you better be taught to question it as well. And I think that that's a mistake we make.
The path that you described in those words and the stages, that I think could help so many people understand how, like you said, it didn't happen overnight. It happened in stages, and it didn't just happen with me and my parents and my sisters. It happened with our entire community, our church community, our neighborhood, everybody on some level, except those few people who maybe had kind of a, maybe they had a funny feeling, but the majority of people all loved this guy, right. And there was no way that he hurt me. And so why would, and they put the pressure on my parents. They did it for him, like not to file the charges and not to go through with it. And of course, the documentary again leaves out the part where my parents rescinded that. There's a whole newspaper article, the Brobergs rescind their, you know, those, the thing that was
affidavits, yeah.
Yeah, they rescind those and they take it back and they want the, you know, the federal, the government to move forward in the case and all of that. They, I mean, there's an article in the newspaper. I have the article and, but some of those things didn't get finished in the documentary. There's so much more. And that is one of the most important parts of my story is I'm like, wait a minute, this didn't happen overnight. We were friends, best friends. We had done hundreds of activities with this family for almost 3 years while he was planning the perfect crime, while he was creating subterfuge over here and chaos over there and doing what he did to separate and divide and conquer. That's what he was doing.
Right.
But the way you describe those stages, that is exactly how it happens. And so that could be such a telling, wonderful way to educate and raise awareness because it was perfect. I was like, yep. And then that, yep, 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 yep.
Great.
Yeah, well, I'll definitely send you some more information. And I highly recommend Jess Hill's book, See What You Made Me Do. And we'll put it in the show notes, but we interviewed Jess and I've done, you know, most of my work's been in this area. So there's certainly things I can send you that will help you because I know you want to raise awareness still. You're talking to people.
Jan, I just wanted to comment on a statement that you made earlier that we hear a lot from people who were victimized and survive sexual victimization, and that is my guy, my same guy. And I think it's important to distinguish and to separate you from that person. And I think it's, you know, you can find the best way to do it, but the same offender or the same criminal, the criminal who offended against me. The reason why is that we really are careful looking at listening to people's behavior and the words that come out of their mouth. And a lot of times we'll hear an somebody say, oh, that child or the girl, right? And we look at that, Laura and I hear that, and we say, that person has already distanced themselves from their daughter. Why? Did they kill their daughter? Do they know what really happened? Is she really missing? Those kinds of questions come up in our field. And so that's because when people have actually killed their daughter and then reported them missing, they've already separated in their mind from that person, from the daughter they love, supposedly. So what I'm saying, psychologically, it could help you because I know you ended this documentary by saying the one person I want to forget about, I want to think about the least, is the one I think about every day. Mm. And one of the steps to do that is to make him a separate entity. He's not your anything. He is the man who targeted you and your family and committed a series of crimes against you over a number of years that seriously affected your life. And he should be labeled as such. He doesn't have a connection to you. He doesn't have any right to be connected to you. So you can separate that. And it's just a small way to move forward and not carry him along with you.
Oh, I really love that, because I think that that is part of the, certainly would make a difference in the healing process. And I feel like I've come a long way, but I want to be able to, you know, go the distance and make sure that others have the pathway to do that. So just hearing that really resonates with me. And I like the idea that I can call him the criminal, you know, to be given permission to say that and to be, you know, he did, and he committed so many crimes against me and against my family. And that feels good to be able to say it that way.
Good.
It feels right.
Good.
Thank you.
Right. Jim and Laura, my question to you is, even though this abuser seems to be really similar to others we've studied, you know, Sandusky and unfortunately so many others, but isn't Jan's situation unique and unusual in the way that he took her away to marry her? That the others that we've studied, they kind of want to stay in the community and operate under the radar and keep everything they have. But to actually take her physically away,
absolutely right. In my mind, that tells me that his level of criminal sophistication was very low, even though his level of manipulation and sophistication in terms of grooming and accomplishing that part of the crime is very high. The problem is, with abductions, as you found out, the FBI gets involved. If you can just groom victims and their parents and guardians and the community and stay in the community, then you don't raise any alarms. He would never have been arrested had he not taken you. That was the thing that got people alarmed. And that's why most of those cases, abduction cases, are stranger danger. There's one very notorious case. I don't want to talk about it in specific because I've talked to the survivor of it, but where an instructor or coach took a boy across country. He did very much the same thing. And it was the same thing. He was going to go shopping with the boy and got him in the car and didn't come back. And then there was negotiations with the mother on the phone as well. There was a lot of similarities. And when they arrested him, they brought him back. His father actually was laying in wait in the airport, and he killed him in front of the news cameras.
Wow.
And in that case, there was a tremendous amount of manipulation, not only of the child and of the parents, but of the community. And this was a pillar of the community offender, as that's what we call them, an acquaintance. And those people are the most difficult to actually build cases against, because so many people believe that they're good people. And this is the problem. And this is the, I hope you can get people to understand this. You can be a pillar of the community, a good person, a good father, and still be sexually attracted to children and be a child sex offender. You can still be the first three things. It is not only evil monsters. It is not people that you can identify by sight or even by behavior in public. It's the private behavior. Sexual behavior is generally private. Criminal sexual behavior is extremely private. So don't think you're going to be able to identify somebody by what they're doing in extreme private. You just don't know about it. So understand that people, these offenders, use our assumptions about life and about relationships and about goodness and kindness. And they believe that child sex offenders have none of those. It's just not true.
They hide in plain sight. And that's always the challenge. I was having the conversation with someone else this morning about that, where someone gave a character reference for an abuser. Well, he was great to me. He was always nice to me. You know, these things that are just said repeatedly. But I do think that in his case, he used charm as a weapon to disarm people. He was very charming, and many perpetrators do use that as a tool to increase likability, to ensure that everybody rallies for them and says what a great person they are, ergo they could never be doing what's being said. But I think in this case, when I understand the behavior and just talking with you, Jan, I really think that he understood his relationship with you as being an intimate relationship, that he liked the imbalance in age. It put him as God in his world, the adoration that it brought, and therefore the wanting to marry you, to take you away, was to ensure that he could monopolize you 100% and be with you 100% without any interference from anybody else. And that's what you tend to see with those who coercively control. They don't want other people around. They may be able to deal with it in the early stages, but ultimately they don't want mum asking questions, dad asking questions, sisters asking questions, or anybody else. They want 100% monopoly. And then that renders you 100% their property, that you are owned by them. You are their right, their entitlement, and you are 100% entrapped. That is the difference in this case, that he had thought out some of the taking you away. He wasn't as criminally sophisticated, probably, as what he would have thought, just given that he smashed the window from the inside out. There were certain things that he did, weren't there, Jim, that were big tells that we would have understood things immediately. But I think what was also telling was that when you said when you reached 16, he was no longer interested. So it really puts him in that ballpark. He was after girls that he could 100% manipulate, monopolize, and dominate in every way. But he would go for adult women too, if it were part of his desire to be able to control or use people and exploit people. And everybody had a use to him. He objectified everybody, from what I could tell, if everybody had a use. And they didn't realize they were being used, but they were. It was all about what he wanted, his ego, his narcissism, the me, myself, and I, his needs being met to the detriment of everybody else's. And that's why he died by suicide. He takes his own life as the ultimate act of control. And I understand it as the ultimate act of control. I'm going to end this on my terms, nobody else's terms. And it always seemed to me to be that way. It was always his way or the highway.
What was it like to sit across from her mother? Because so many people blame the parents, Bob and Mary Ann. Do they deserve that blame? Let me start there.
I don't think they do. But I can also understand why people are blaming them, because I think it's really, really hard to kind of turn that mirror around and yep. look at ourselves and what we could possibly do. Sitting in the room with them during those interviews was so hard. I mean, it was such an emotional room. You know, we were all crying at times. We were laughing at times too, but they were long interviews. You know, they were 8 or 10 hour long interviews. So it was a lot of kind of deep, dark secrets exposed over a long amount of time. And it was just, it was really emotional. It was really wonderful. It was really
vulnerable.
I felt completely honored mm-hmm. that they shared this with me, but it was horrible. I mean, it was the first time really that Mary Ann and Bob Broberg had really talked about their sexual indiscretions in a very public way. And I believe in my heart of hearts that they did that because they knew that these were two very important pieces to the puzzle
yep.
that they hadn't really talked about before. Because in the book, they left both of those instances out.
One of the last scenes where I saw you confront him in court was just so powerful that I wanted to ask you about that, because not many people have the ability, i.e. to advocate for themselves, but you are put in a courtroom with him, what, 30 years later?
Yep.
Were you cross-examined by him?
Well, this is how it worked. I filed a stalking injunction because he had shown up at this. I was doing a speaking engagement in this community where I live, and at the university, and he showed up in a van
I saw my picture on a poster, found out that he with, and I know these girls too. I've talked to them, these stepdaughters of his who had run away from home at this point and came to this speaking engagement and said, that's the woman that gave us life. That's the one who's married to this guy. And we've run away from home. They hadn't even called her mother for years, these two other girls, the victims after the other girl I was talking about earlier. And they identified when their mother, who they didn't call that, walked into my speaking, my conference. It was for, there was about 800 women and their daughters there that were university students and their moms. And this was the subject, was telling my story and talking about this. This is, again, you know, what I've been doing for many, many years. And he showed up. He came in a van with a gun. And so because of that, all of a sudden they're taking me off the stand of, you know, where I'm giving my speech. And it was almost the end of it. And people are standing up and clapping. And all of a sudden the police are like, we think he's in the parking lot. And this whole thing that unfolded, well, that's what caused me to find out he was just living like an hour from where I live and had remarried this woman who had two little young daughters and who had run away from home, I found out, and we're at this conference. So anyway, all these things that have happened in the course of time. So when I found all of that out and I thought, oh my gosh, this man, this criminal lives, you know, right down in Logandale, Nevada, an hour from St. George, Utah. I had no idea. And so that's when I filed a stalking injunction and he contested it. And so because of the way the laws work, he had every right to be in that courtroom and was sitting right there, you know, 10 feet from me. And I hadn't seen him since I was a little girl. And literally the first, I would say maybe 20 or 30 minutes, I was just shaking. Like, you know, my body was trembling and I was shaking, but I was determined I was going to sit there and I was going to be, you know, a big girl here, a big mama lion. But what triggered me, what really brought out the mama tiger in me was when he said, well, I guess, you know, she's an actress. I guess she wanted her 15 minutes of fame. So she's made up this story to destroy my life. And, you know, how's it going? Has somebody made a movie about this yet?
Such bullshit.
And I was so angry.
Good.
That was the moment. And, you know, we were given basically equal time. And that's when I stood up and I pointed at him and I said, Mr. Birchtold, the only reason that I am telling my story is to protect other, you know, other girls or families from monsters.
You're our
like
hero.
Absolutely.
our hero.
From that point on, I was calm. It was so amazing. Mm. And my sister, who is an attorney, had prepared this huge file and the judge came back and not only granted me the stalking injunction, which is usually a 3-year term, but for the rest of his natural life. And then that all that happened is what led us to court him finally to going to court 2 years later, and nothing to do with raping little girls. But that's when I found out a bunch of other stories from other women. But he was found guilty of two misdemeanors and three felony charges. And when he left the courtroom and was finally going to be sentenced a month later, that's when he took off in his truck and they escorted him back to the Nevada border. And the police were there to escort him to his home because he had a heart condition. And so they were releasing him to his home until sentencing. And that's when he drove out into the desert on kind of a high-speed chase and ditched the police and killed himself.
Wow. I mean, firstly, you were just so incredible in that moment. Your strength and your determination was just amazing. Your voice was so even when you answered him. I can't even imagine how that felt of being confronted in court, sitting next to the perpetrator and him basically saying you were lying. This is about getting your 10 minutes of fame, which a lot of people buy into that bullshit, by the way. That's how girls and women aren't believed. But the fact that you just turn around and say, my goal is to educate the public about predators like you. It was so incredible. And you took your power back, I believe, on that day. I felt you take your power back and I could see it on camera, which is just amazing. You're a warrior. I wouldn't say it's your tigress. I'd say it was your absolute warrior moment of taking your life back and holding him to account. And the front and the audacity and the arrogance from him. And you should never be in a position where you are in court with the stalker, the perpetrator, and sat in proximity to them. and them having a dialogue with you like that. I mean, it's absolutely outrageous. That should never happen, to be re-victimized. But I'm just so glad you found your voice in that moment and you took your power back and you put him in his place as the small individual that he was, who preyed on a young girl and her family. And fortunately, he is no longer of this world. But what a moment. I couldn't believe it. And it sounds like there's so much more to your story. I could talk to you for hours, probably days, yeah. Jan.
That's so, right. There's so many things.
We all could. Yeah.
So many questions. Oh. So I'm glad that you're working on another project and we're going to hear more, and you've stepped into your power as an advocate. So I just want to thank you for using your voice and being courageous to try and help others.
I'm sure Laura would be able to really educate people on coercive control and how people use it against domestic partners and against children and people outside of the home, as well as all the information that we have about offender behavior, child sex crimes, and child abduction. So,
well, you're
we can
all
help.
So,
we'd love to.
Oh, I would love that. And you're so smart, and you've worked in these fields, and you give me not only the encouragement, but the words, because sometimes I'm trying to describe something, and I run out of, like, how do you describe something like this? And so today has been very important for me. I've learned something from all three of you, actually. And it's like, that's the kind of thing that if we can have that dialogue and it can keep going, maybe we can make an impact. And that's really the reason. Would I have ever exposed my family to some of the hurtful things that have been said or whatever? I wouldn't have, because I would never have survived without the family that I had, the parents that I had. I mean, they just, when I was screaming and mad and angry, they just listened and loved me and said, "You have every right to be mad. We should have been smarter. We should have done better." You know, and that was in my early 20s. You know, that was over by the time I was, you know, 26 or 7. But they just always were that way. We talked around the dinner table. I had a family that, you know, my parents listened to us. They wanted to buy a bigger house, and we didn't want to move out of our neighborhood, and we didn't, because they cared about what we thought. And because that had been established before all of this happened, I had something to go back to, right, and to be, you know, fortified by. So without the, you know, it's a double-edged sword, I guess. My parents could have done better, but without them, without my sisters, my best friend, and my many other friends and family and community and church members and all the people that came to rally and to help in some way, I wouldn't have survived. And yet many people made mistakes. I was frustrated that people don't know when they're the victim. Like, I look at my mom and dad, they'd never, ever, ever had any run-in with any legal thing in their lives. They don't even know the questions to ask, and neither do people today. My sister's an attorney, and she said the biggest problem, she works in immigration, she said, is people don't even know the questions. So you have to dig deep to find, you know, the answers. So you're trying to help people, and they don't even know. My mom and dad didn't know that they shouldn't talk to an attorney for him. My mom and dad didn't have an attorney. They weren't the criminals. They weren't on trial. People never think of those things.
Right.
But, you know, when she calls and says, "Hey, we can make this all go away." Oh, good. You know, we want to go on with our lives. Our daughter's home. We're ready to move on. They had no idea, you know, and those are the things that I think people immediately jump to and judge. And you're like, my mom and dad never had an attorney. They never needed one. They're not criminals, you know? So it's interesting. You don't even know the right questions to ask sometimes. And that's where I think it has to get very basic for people to start to understand not only my story, but their own stories and how to prevent and remedy this huge issue with child abuse in general, but certainly sexual child abuse, which, like you said, is a deeply, deeply covered, you know, it's not on the surface.
Here's another word for you, or a couple of words: conspiracy of silence. There is a conspiracy of silence around it. And part of that is due to grooming. Part of that is due to how uncomfortable people are talking about the subject. Part of it is because parents don't talk to their children about sex. And so anytime that sexual topics come up, they whisper, they turn it down on the TV or the radio. So children get the idea, oh, that's not a topic I can talk to my parents about. But these offenders are out there just loving that because they want the opportunity to talk to kids about sex. So there's all sorts of things that we can add. And like Laura and Lisa said, we'd love to talk to you for many more days. We don't want to wear you out, though. But, but we'd
we can
be happy,
do this again.
And we'd be happy to be a part of anything that you do in the background, if you want, or the foreground. We would be happy to help you get the word out, because that's been our mission professionally for Laura and I. And since we started Real Crime Profile, Lisa joined the gang, and we've been getting the word out around the world now. So that's a really cool thing.
Amazing. What I'd really like is for us to do a podcast with my entire family and my extended family. I mean, literally, I would love it if we had experts like you guys, and you could delve in with my mom while she's still alive. You could delve in with our children who have been affected by what happened to my sisters, because there is something there that every person around a kidnapping or an abuse story like mine has gone through. And it's so intriguing. We get people around us and they're like, oh my gosh, I've never even thought about, you know, what's Karen's story here and what happened, you know, it's so interesting. And when I read her little journal the other day, I just called her up and I was crying. I was like, oh my gosh, the level of pain that you were in by having your best friend ripped away from you and having him move. And just, you know, she was so mad at my dad at something because he's acting like, you know, the Berchtolds are all this and that. And she was so mad, you know, and I'm like, you see how deeply this family, this man had inserted himself into each one of us.
Right.
Yeah. It's amazing. It's amazing. Yeah, there's a lot to talk about.
Well, hopefully they can all listen to this podcast and they'll be educated by that. And then we could follow up with another where they can ask us questions and we'll be happy to answer them.
As we wrap up, Jen, I just want to end where we started. I hope people can go back and watch your Criminal Minds episode. It's called The Return. It was in season 9, written by Kimberly Harrison. And I just want to share with you, you know, one of the reasons why we cast you is that, you know, God knows I didn't know anything about what you'd been through, but something about you carried the pain that this mother needed to have, her child being abducted and not knowing where he was. And there's something that this is a compliment. It's not going to sound like one, but there's a damage to you that makes you very vulnerable and very evocative and very
wonderful. When you're acting.
Yes. This is my professional opinion.
I know. Right. I'd like to just also add that you have an amazing personality. I mean, people saw it when you were a child. I love your personality now. You've been through a lot, but I love how resilient you are.
Mm-hmm.
And you still obviously have such a great joy of life. And that's a great thing.
You've got a depth to you.
Mm-hmm.
And that depth of emotion, you know, when we suffer trauma, we can get post-traumatic growth. And it allows us to reach our true potential as human beings. So carry it as a positive, because it gives us depth. It makes us understand things with real emotional clarity and depth. And that's probably what Lisa was seeing when you were playing to the full range of that emotion. But your disposition is so sunny and bright, and you're an absolute joy to talk with.
Oh, thank you. All three of you gave me a compliment that I really appreciate. Thank you.
Right. Well, Jen, it has been a pleasure and an honor speaking to you about this really disturbing set of circumstances. And what I love most about our interaction is just how joyful you are. And I'm so happy that you are a shining example of why it's wrong to say that being sexually victimizes, destroys a child's life, robs them of their soul, kills their spirit. It doesn't have to. It is a terrible thing, but you can survive and you can live a wonderful life and still find joy. So thank you so much, Jen.
Thank you. I appreciate that, because that for me is the crux of why I want to tell my story, is that I want people to go away and know that they have a choice in how the next day of their life goes, and the one after that, and the one after that, and the year after that, and that you do have a choice. And you do have hope, and you may need a lot of help, But you can have a life filled with absolute joy, and you don't have to let this define you. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you so much. From all of us at Real Crime Profile, and from all of our listeners around the world. Till next time, thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile. Signing out.
If you like deeper analysis like this episode on topics like Making a Murderer, Mindhunter, Escape at Dannemora,
the case of Sally Challen, the teacher's pet, Lynette Dawson, the Exonerated Five and When They See Us, and the disappearance of Madeleine McCann, you can listen to RCP on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or whatever platform you listen to us on. And please be sure, if you like what we do, to give us a 5-star review.
Thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107. Or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 200 0247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214-946-4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.